13. Down on the farm. Alarmed by Esther Wren's sudden reappearance, his familiarity with my affairs and the fierce urgency of his warnings, I hailed a taxi and drove straight to Obsley's Island, meaning to ask the commensal how Estravan knew so much and why he had suddenly popped up from nowhere, urging me to do precisely what Obsley yesterday had advised against doing. The commensal was out. The doorkeeper did not know where he was or when he would be in. I went to Yege's house with no better luck. A heavy snow, the heaviest of autumn so far, was falling. My driver refused to take me farther than to Shuskiz's house, as he did not have snow cleats on his tires. That evening, I failed to reach Obsley, Yege, or Slos by telephone. At dinner, Shuskiz explained a Yomish festival was going on, the solemnity of the saints and throne upholders, and the high officials of the commensality were expected to be seen at the temples. He also explained Estraven's behavior shrewdly enough as that of a man once powerful and now fallen, who grasps at any chance to influence persons or events, always less rationally, more desperately as time passes, and he knows himself sinking into powerless anonymity. I agreed that this would explain Estravan's anxious, almost frantic manner. The anxiety had, however, infected me. I was vaguely ill at ease all through that long and heavy meal. Shuskiz talked and talked to me and to the many employees, aides, and sycophants who sat down at his table nightly. I had never known him so long-winded, so relentlessly jovial. When dinner was over, it was pretty late for going out again, and in any case the solemnity would keep all the commensals busy, Shuskiz said, until after midnight. I decided to pass up supper, so went to bed early. Sometime between midnight and dawn, I was awakened by strangers, informed that I was under arrest, and taken by an armed guard to the Kundershardin prison. Kundershardin is old, one of the very few old buildings left in Mishnori. I had noticed it often as I went about the city. A long, grimy, many-towered, ill-looking place, distinct among the pallid bulks and hulks of the commensal edifices. It is what it looks like, and is called. It is a jail. It is not a front for something else, not a facade, not a pseudonym. It is real, the real thing, the thing behind the words. The guards, a sturdy, solid lot, hustled me through the corridors and left me alone in a small room, very dirty and very brightly lit. In a few minutes, another lot of guards came crowding in as escort to a thin-faced man with an air of authority. He dismissed all but two. I asked him if I would be allowed to send word to the commensal Obsley.
The commensal knows of your arrest.
I said, knows of it? Very stupidly.
My superiors act, of course, by order of the 33. You will now undergo interrogation.
The guards caught my arms.
I resisted them, saying angrily, I'm willing to answer what you ask. You can leave out the intimidation.
The thin-faced man paid no attention, but called back another guard. The three of them got me strapped on a pull-down table, stripped me, and injected me with, I suppose, one of the veridical drugs. I don't know how long the questioning lasted, or what it concerned, as I was drugged more or less heavily all the time and have no memory of it. When I came to myself again, I had no idea how long I had been kept in Kundershardin, 4 or 5 days, judging by my physical condition, but I was not sure. For some while after that, I did not know what day of the month it was, nor what month. And in fact, I came only slowly to comprehend my surroundings at all. I was in a caravan truck, much like the truck that had carried me over the Kargav to Rer, but in the van, not the cab. There were 20 or 30 other people in with me. Hard to tell how many, since there were no windows and light came only through a slit in the rear door, screened with 4 thicknesses of steel mesh. We had evidently been traveling some while when I recovered conscious thought, as each person's place was more or less defined, and the smell of excreta, vomit, and sweat had already reached a point it neither surpassed nor declined from. No one knew any of the others. No one knew where we were being taken. There was little talking. It was the second time I had been locked in the dark with uncomplaining, unhopeful people of Orgorain. I knew now the sign I had been given. My first night in this country. I had ignored that black cellar and gone looking for the substance of Orgarain above ground, in daylight. No wonder nothing had seemed real. I felt that the truck was going east and couldn't get rid of this impression even when it became plain that it was going west, farther and farther into Orgarain. One's magnetic and directional substances are all wrong on other planets. When the intellect won't or can't compensate for that wrongness, the result is a profound bewilderment, a feeling that everything, literally, has come loose. One of the truckload died that night. He had been clubbed or kicked in the abdomen and died hemorrhaging from anus and mouth. No one did anything for him. There was nothing to be done. A plastic jug of water had been shoved in amongst us some hours before, but it was long since dry. The man happened to be next to me on the right, and I took his head on my knees to give him relief in breathing. So he died. We were all naked, but thereafter I wore his blood for clothing on my legs and thighs and hands, a dry, stiff, brown garment with no warmth in it. The night grew bitter, and we had to get close together for warmth. The corpse, having nothing to give, was pushed out of the group, excluded. The rest of us huddled together, swaying and jolting all in one motion all night. Darkness was total inside our still box. We were on some country road, and no truck followed us. Even with the face pressed up close to the mesh, one could see nothing out of the door slit but darkness and the vague loom of fallen snow. Fallen snow. New fallen snow. Long fallen snow. Snow after rain has fallen on it. Refrozen snow. Orgota and Karhidish have a word for each of these. In Karhidish, which I know better than Orgota, they have, by my count, 62 words for the various kinds, states, ages, and qualities of snow. Fallen snow, that is. There is another set of words for the varieties of snowfall, another for ice, a set of 20 or more that define what the temperature range is, how strong a wind blows, and what kind of precipitation is occurring all together. I sat and tried to draw up lists of those words in my head that night. Each time I recalled another one, I would repeat the lists, inserting it in its alphabetical place. Along after dawn, the truck stopped. People screamed out the slit that there was a dead body in the truck. Come and take it out. One after another of us screamed and shouted. We pounded together on the sides and doors, making so hideous a pandemonium inside the steel box that we could not stand it ourselves. No one came. The truck stood still for some hours. At last, there was a sound of voices outside. The truck lurched, skidding on an ice patch, and set off again. One could see through the slit that it was late on a sunny morning, and that we were going through wooded hills. The truck continued thus for 3 more days and nights, 4 in all since my awakening. It made no stops at inspection points, and I think it never passed through a town of any size. Its journey was erratic, furtive. There were stops to change drivers and recharge batteries. There were other, longer stops for no reason that could be discerned from inside the van. 2 of the days it sat still from noon till dark, as if deserted. Then began its run again at night. Once a day, around noon, a big jug of water was passed in through a trap in the door. Counting the corpse, there were 26 of us, 2 13s. Gathenians often think in 13s. 26 is 52s, no doubt because of the 26-day lunar cycle that makes their unvarying month and approximates their sexual cycle. The corpse was shoved up tight against the steel doors that formed the rear wall of our box, where he would keep cold. The rest of us sat and lay crouched, each in his own place, his territory, his domain, until night, when the cold grew so extreme that, little by little, we drew together and merged into one entity occupying one space, warm in the middle, cold at the periphery. There was kindness. I and certain others, an old man and one with a bad cough, were recognized as being least resistant to the cold, and each night we were at the center of the group, the entity of 25, where it was warmest. We did not struggle for the warm place. We simply were in it each night. It is a terrible thing, this kindness that human beings do not lose. Terrible because when we are finally naked in the dark and cold, it is all we have. We who are so rich, so full of strength, we end up with that small change. We have nothing else to give. Despite our crowdedness and our huddling together nights, we in the truck were remote from one another. Some were stupefied from drugging. Some were probably mental or social defectives to start with. All were abused and scared. Yet it may be strange that among 25, not one ever spoke to all the others together, not even to curse them. Kindness there was, and endurance, but in silence, always in silence. Jammed together in the sour darkness of our shared mortality, we bumped one another continually, jolted together, fell over one another, breathed our breaths mingling, laid the heat of our bodies together as a fire is laid, but remained strangers. I never learned the name of any of them in the truck. One day, the third day, I think, when the truck stopped still for hours, and I wondered if they had simply left us in some desert place to rot, one of them began to talk to me. He kept telling me a long story about a mill in South Orgeren, where he had worked, and how he had got into trouble with an overseer. He talked and talked in his soft, dull voice, and kept putting his hand on mine, as if to be sure he had my attention. The sun was getting west of us, and as we stood slewed around on the shoulder of the road, a shaft of light entered in the window slit. Suddenly, even back in the box, one could see. I saw a girl, a filthy, pretty, stupid, weary girl, looking up into my face as she talked, smiling timidly, looking for solace. The young Orgota was in Kema, and had been drawn to me. The one time any one of them asked anything of me, and I couldn't give it. I got up and went to the window slit as if for air and a lookout, and did not come back to my place for a long time. That night, the truck went up long grades, down, up again. From time to time it halted inexplicably. At each halt, a frozen, unbroken silence lay outside the steel walls of our box, the silence of vast wastelands, of the heights. The one in Kema still kept the place beside mine, and still sought to touch me. I stood up for a long time again, with my face pressed to the steel mesh of the window, breathing clean air that cut my throat and lungs like a razor. My hands pressed against the metal door became numb. I realized that at last they were, or soon would be, frostbitten. My breath had made a little ice bridge between my lips and the mesh. I had to break this bridge with my fingers before I could turn away. When I huddled down with the others, I began to shake with cold, a kind of shaking I had not experienced, jumping, racking spasms like the convulsions of fever. The truck started up again. Noise and motion gave an illusion of warmth, dispelling that utter glacial silence, but I was still too cold to sleep that night. I thought we were at a fairly high altitude most of the night, but it was hard to tell, one's breathing, heartbeat, and energy level being unreliable indicators given the circumstances. As I knew later, we were crossing the Sembenzians that night, and must have gone up over 9,000 feet on the passes. I was not much troubled by hunger. The last meal I remembered eating was that long and heavy dinner in Shuskis's house. They must have fed me in Kundershaden, but I had no recollection of it. Eating did not seem to be a part of this existence in the steel box, and I did not often think about it. Thirst, on the other hand, was one of the permanent conditions of life. Once daily at a stop, the trap evidently set into the rear door for this purpose was unbolted. One of us thrust out the plastic jug, and it was soon thrust back in, filled, along with a brief gust of icy air. There was no way to measure out the water among us. The jug was passed, and each got three or four good swallows before the next hand reached for it. No one person or group acted as dispensers or guardians. None saw to it that a drink was saved for the man who coughed, though he was now in a high fever. I suggested this once, and those around me nodded, but it was not done. The water was shared more or less equally. No one ever tried to get much more than his share, and was gone within a few minutes. Once, the last three, up against the forward wall of the box, got none, the jug being dry when it came to them. The next day, two of them insisted on being first in line, and were. The third lay huddled in his front corner, unstirring. And nobody saw to it that he got his share. Why didn't I try to? I don't know. That was the fourth day in the truck. If I had been passed over, I'm not sure I would have made an effort to get my share. I was aware of his thirst and his suffering, and the sick man's, and the others, much as I was aware of my own. I was unable to do anything about any of this suffering, and therefore accepted it, as they did, placidly. I know that people might behave very differently in the same circumstances. These were Orgota, people trained from birth in a discipline of cooperation, obedience, submission to a group purpose ordered from above. The qualities of independence and decision were weakened in them. They had not much capacity for anger. They formed a whole, I among them. Each felt it, and it was a refuge and true comfort in the night, that wholeness of the huddled group, each drawing life from the others. But there was no spokesman for the whole. It was headless, passive. Men whose will was tempered to a sharper edge might have done much better, talked more, shared the water more justly, given more ease to the sick, and kept their courage higher. I don't know. I only know what it was like inside that truck. On the fifth morning, if my count is right, from the day I wakened in the truck, it stopped. We heard talking outside and calling back and forth. The steel rear doors were unbolted from the outside and flung wide open. One by one we crept to that open end of the steel box, some on hands and knees, and jumped or crawled down onto the ground. 24 of us did. 2 dead men, the old corpse and a new one, the one who had not got his drink of water for 2 days, were dragged out. It was cold outside, so cold and so glaring with white sunlight on white snow, that to leave the fetid shelter of the truck was very hard, and some of us wept. We stood bunched up beside the great truck, all of us naked and stinking, our little hole, our night entity exposed to the bright, cruel daylight. They broke us up, made us form a line, and led us towards a building a few hundred yards away. The metal walls and snow-covered roof of the building, the plain of the snow all around, the great range of mountains that lay under the rising sun, the vast sky, all seemed to shake and glitter with excess of light. We were lined up to wash ourselves at a big trough in a frame hut. Everybody began by drinking the wash water. After that, we were led into the main building and given undershirts, grey felt shirts, breeches, leggings, and felt boots. A guard checked off our names on a list as we filed into the refectory, where, with 100 or more other people in grey, we sat at bolted down tables and were served breakfast, grain porridge and beer. After that, the whole lot of us, new prisoners and old, were divided up into squads of 12. My squad was taken to a sawmill a few hundred yards behind the main building, inside the fence. Outside the fence, and not far from it, a forest began that covered the folded hills as far to northward as the eye could see. Under the direction of our guard, we carried and stacked sawn boards from the mill to a huge shed where lumber was stored through the winter. It was not easy to walk, stoop, and lift loads after the days in the truck. They didn't let us stand idle, but they didn't force the pace either. In the middle of the day, we were served a cupful of the unfermented grain brew, Orsh. Before sunset, we were taken back to the barracks and given dinner, porridge with some vegetables, and beer. By nightfall, we were locked into the dormitory, which was kept fully lighted all night. We slept on 5-foot-deep shelves all around the walls of the room in 2 tiers. Old prisoners scrambled for the upper tier, the more desirable since heat rises. For bedding, each man was issued a sleeping bag at the door. They were coarse, heavy bags, foul with other men's sweat, but well insulated and warm. Their drawback for me was their shortness. An average-sized Gathenian could get clear inside head and all, but I couldn't, nor could I ever stretch out fully on the sleeping shelf. The place was called Pulafen Commensality 3rd Voluntary Farm and Resettlement Agency. Pulafen District 30 is in the extreme northwest of the habitable zone of Orgorain, bounded by the Sebenzian Mountains, the Isagal River, and the coast. The area is thinly settled, without big cities. The town nearest was a place called Turuf, several miles to the southwest. I never saw it. The farm was on the edge of a great unpopulated forest region, Tarampeth. Too far north for the larger trees, Hemen or Serem or Black Fate, the forest was all of one kind of tree, a gnarled, scrubby conifer 10 or 12 feet high, grey-needled, called Thore. Though the number of native species, plant or animal, on winter is unusually small, the membership of each species is very large. There were thousands of square miles of Thore trees and nothing else in that forest. Even the wilderness is carefully husbanded there. And though that forest had been logged for centuries, there were no waste places in it, no desolations of stumps, no eroded slopes. It seemed that every tree in it was accounted for, and that not one grain of sawdust from our mill went unused. There was a small plant on the farm, and when the weather prevented parties from going out into the forest, we worked in the mill or in the plant, treating and compressing chips, bark, and sawdust into various forms and extracting from the dried thore needles a resin used in plastics. The work was genuine work, and we were not overdriven. If they had allowed a little more food and better clothing, much of the work would have been pleasant, but we were too hungry and cold most of the time for any pleasure. The guards were seldom harsh and never cruel. They tended to be stolid, slovenly, heavy, and to my eyes, effeminate. Not in the sense of delicacy, etc., but just in the opposite sense, a gross, bland fleshiness, a bovinity without point or edge. Among my fellow prisoners, I had also for the first time on winter a certain feeling of being a man among women, or among eunuchs. The prisoners had that same flabbiness and coarseness. They were hard to tell apart. Their emotional tone seemed always low, their talk trivial. I took this lifelessness and leveling at first for the effect of the privation of food, warmth, and liberty, but I soon found out that it was more specific an effect than that. It was the result of the drugs given all prisoners to keep them out of Kemah. I knew that drugs existed, which could reduce or virtually eliminate the potency phase of the Gathenian sexual cycle. They were used when convenience, medicine, or morality dictated abstinence. One Kemah, or several, could be skipped thus without ill effect. The voluntary use of such drugs was common and accepted. It had not occurred to me that they might be administered to unwilling persons. There were good reasons. A prisoner in Kemah would be a disruptive element in his work squad. If let off work, what was to be done with him? Especially if no other prisoner was in Kemah at the time, as was possible, there being only some 150 of us. To go through Kemah without a partner is pretty hard on a Gathenian. Better then simply obviate the misery and wasted work time and not go through Kemah at all. So they prevented it. Prisoners who had been there for several years were psychologically and, I believe, to some extent, physically adapted to this chemical castration. They were as sexless as steers. They were without shame and without desire, like the angels. But it is not human to be without shame and without desire. Being so strictly defined and limited by nature, the sexual urge of Gathenians is really not much interfered with by society. There is less coding, channeling, and repressing of sex there than in any bisexual society I know of. Abstinence is entirely voluntary. Indulgence is entirely acceptable. Sexual fear and sexual frustration are both extremely rare. This was the first case I had seen of the social purpose running counter to the sexual drive. Being a suppression, not merely a repression, it produced not frustration, but something more ominous, perhaps in the long run, passivity. There are no communal insects on winter. Gathenians do not share their earth as Terrans do with those older societies, those innumerable cities of little sexless workers possessing no instinct but that of obedience to the group, the whole. If there were ants on winter, Gathenians might have tried to imitate them long ago. The regime of the voluntary farms is a fairly recent thing, limited to one country of the planet and literally unknown elsewhere. But it is an ominous sign of the direction that a society of people so vulnerable to sexual control might take. At Pullifen Farm, we were, as I said, underfed for the work we did, and our clothing, particularly our footgear, was completely inadequate for that winter climate. The guards, most of them probationary prisoners, were not much better off. The intent of the place and its regime was punitive, but not destructive. and I think it might have been endurable without druggings and the examinations. Some of the prisoners underwent the examination in groups of 12. They merely recited a sort of confessional and catechism, got their anti-chemo shot, and were released to work. Others, the political prisoners, were subjected every fifth day to questioning under drugs. I don't know what drugs they used. I don't know the purpose of the questioning. I have no idea what questions they asked me. I would come to myself in the dormitory after a few hours, laid out on the sleeping shelf with six or seven others, some waking like myself, some still slack and blank in the grip of the drug. When we were all afoot, the guards would take us out to the plant to work, but after the third or fourth of these examinations, I was unable to get up. They let me be, and next day I could go out with my squad, though I felt shaky. After the next examination, I was helpless for 2 days. Either the anti-chemo hormones or the veridicals evidently had a toxic effect on my non-Gathenian nervous system, and the effect was cumulative. I remember planning how I would plead with the inspector when the next examination came. I would start by promising to answer truthfully anything he asked without drugs, and later I would say to him, "Sir, don't you see how useless it is to know the answer to the wrong question?" Then the inspector would turn into facts, with the foreteller's gold chain around his neck, and I would have long conversations with facts, very pleasantly, while I controlled the drip of acid from a tube into a vat of pulverized wood chips. Of course, when I came to, the little room where they examined us, the inspector's aide had pulled back my collar and given me the injection before I could speak, and all I remember from that session, or perhaps the memories from an earlier one, is the inspector, a tired-looking young Orgota with dirty fingernails, saying drearily, "You must answer my questions in Orgota. You must not speak in any other language. You must speak in Orgota." There was no infirmary. The principle of the farm was work or die. But there were leniencies in practice, gaps between work and death, provided by the guards. As I said, they were not cruel, neither were they kind. They were slipshod and didn't care much, so long as they kept out of trouble themselves. They let me and another prisoner stay in the dormitory, simply left us there in our sleeping bags as if by oversight, when it was plain that we could not stand up on our feet. I was extremely ill after the last examination. The other, a middle-aged fellow, had some disorder or disease of the kidney and was dying. As he could not die all at once, he was allowed to spend some time at it, on the sleeping shelf. I remember him more clearly than anything else in Pulafin Farm. He was physically a typical Gathenian of the great continent, compactly made, short-legged and short-armed, with a solid layer of subcutaneous fat, giving him, even in illness, a sleek roundness of body. He had small feet and hands, rather broad hips, and a deep chest, the breasts scarcely more developed than in a male of my race. His skin was dark, ruddy brown, his black hair fine and fur-like. His face was broad, with small, strong features, the cheekbones pronounced. It is a type not unlike that of various isolated Terran groups living in a very high altitude or Arctic areas. His name was Azra. He had been a carpenter. We talked. Azra was not, I think, unwilling to die, but he was afraid of dying. He sought distraction from his fear. We had little in common, other than our nearness to death, and that was not what we wanted to talk about. So, much of the time, we did not understand each other very well. It did not matter to him. I, younger and incredulous, would have liked understanding, comprehension, explanation, but there was no explanation. We talked. At night, the barracks dormitory was glaring, crowded and noisy. During the day, the lights were turned off, and the big room was dusky, empty, still. We lay close together on the sleeping shelf and talked softly. Azra liked best to tell long, meandering tales about his young days on a commensal farm in the Kundera Valley, that broad, splendid plain I had driven through coming from the border to Mishnori. His dialect was strong, and he used many names of people, places, customs, tools that I did not know the meaning of, so I seldom caught more than the drift of his reminiscences. When he was feeling easiest, usually around noon, I would ask him for a myth or a tale. Most Gathenians are well stuffed with these. Their literature, though it exists in written form, is a live oral tradition, and they are all, in this sense, literate. Azra knew the Orgota staples, the short tales of Meshe, the tales of Parsid, parts of the great epics, and the novel-like sea trader's saga. These, and bits of local lore recalled from his childhood, he would tell in his soft, slurry dialect, and then, growing tired, would ask me for a story. "What do they tell in Karhide?" he would say, rubbing his legs, which tormented him with aches and shooting pains, and turning to me his face with its shy, sly, patient smile. Once I said, "I know a story about people who live on another world." "What kind of world would that be?" "One like this one, all in all. But it doesn't go around the sun. It goes around the star you call Selemi. That's a yellow star like the sun, and on that world, under that sun, live other people." "That's in the Sanovi teachings. That about the other worlds. There used to be an old Sanovi crazy priest would come by my hearth when I was little and tell us children all about that. Where the liars go when they die, and where the suicides go, and where the thieves go. That's where we're going. Me and you, eh? One of those places?" "No. This I'm telling you of isn't a spirit world. A real one. The people that live in it are real people, alive, just like here. But very long ago they learned how to fly." Azra grinned. "Not by flapping their arms, you know. They flew in machines like cars." But it was hard to say in Orgota, which lacks a word meaning precisely to fly. The closest one can come has more the meaning of glide. "Well, they learned how to make machines that went right over the air as a sledge goes over snow. And after a while they learned how to make them go farther and faster, till they went like the stone out of a sling off the earth and over the clouds and out of the air, clear to another world going around another sun. And when they got to that world, what did they find there but men? Sliding in the air? Maybe. Maybe not. When they got to my world, we already knew how to get about in the air, but they taught us how to get from world to world. We didn't yet have the machines for that." Azra was puzzled by the injection of the teller into the tale. I was feverish, bothered by the sores which the drugs had brought out on my arms and chest, and I could not remember how I'd meant to weave the story. "Go on," he said, trying to make sense of it. "What did they do besides go in the air?" "Oh, they did much as people do here, but they're all in camera all the time." He chuckled. There was, of course, no chance of concealment in this life, and my nickname among prisoners and guards was inevitably the pervert. But where there is no desire and no shame, no one, however anomalous, is singled out. And I think Azra made no connection of this notion with myself and my peculiarities. He saw it merely as a variation on an old theme, and so he chuckled a little, and said, "In Kema, all the time." "Is it a place of reward, then, or a place of punishment?" "I don't know, Azra. Which is this world?" "Neither, child. This here is just the world. It's how it is. You get born into it, and things are as they are." "I wasn't born into it. I came to it. I chose it." The silence and the shadow hung around us. Away off in the country silence, beyond the barrack walls, there was one tiny edge of sound, a handsaw, keening. Nothing else. "Ah, well. Ah, well," Azra murmured, and sighed, and rubbed his legs, making a little moaning sound that he was not aware of himself. "We none of us choose," he said. A night or two after that, he went into coma, and presently died. I had not learned what he had been sent to the voluntary farm for, what crime or fault or irregularity in his identification papers, and knew only that he had been in Pulafen Farm less than a year. The day after Azra's death, they called me for examination. This time, they had to carry me in. And I can't remember anything further than that.